greetings to all of our Voice of America listeners. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports Show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports. Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Well, they were indeed playing basketball last night in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and they were making history, and one person in particular making history. Now, all season long, Oklahoma City star point guard Russell Westbrook has been chasing a record set by Oscar Robertson 55 years ago, 41 triple-doubles in a single season. Well, last night, Westbrook scored 12 points, made 13 rebounds, and 13 assists to record his 41st triple-double of the season and tie Robertson's record. Now that Westbrook has reached that record, the question on everyone's mind is, will he break it? With the way he's playing, many are speculating that Westbrook won't just get to the 42 triple-doubles to break the record, but possibly more. However, there is one factor weighing against him: time. With just 5 games left in the regular season, Westbrook has to move quickly if he wants to make National Basketball Association history. But if there's one thing he's shown that he can do, it's move quickly. And if, or when, Westbrook breaks that record, possibly tonight against the Memphis Grizzlies, we'll have the latest reaction here on the Sunny Side of Sports. Well, from the basketball court, we move now to the tennis court, and a living tennis legend who's having one of the best seasons ever. None other than the GOAT, Roger Federer. Here's how Federer's 2017 has shaped up so far. He kicked off the year by capturing his 18th major title at the Australian Open in January. He then went on to win his 5th title at the BNP Paribas Open in Indian Wells, California, and his 3rd at the Miami Open in Miami, Florida. It's the first time that Federer has won those two tournaments in the same year since 2006. Now, that would be an impressive start to the tennis season for any player, but what makes Federer's resurgence especially exciting, and especially unusual, is that he's doing it at the age of 35, a point when most professional tennis players aren't even playing anymore, let alone playing some of the best tennis of their careers. I wanted to find out why Federer is playing so well, so I went to Giddy Nathan, a tennis writer for sports site Deadspin.com, and I had to start our interview with that first question. So Roger Federer already winning 3 tournaments this year, including the Australian Open. He's doing it at the age of 35. Why is he playing arguably the best tennis of his career right now?
It's honestly unbelievable. I think any time you see someone in their late career taken out by injury for 6 months the way he was, and some of that was voluntary. I think he would rather have rested up completely. He'd had a knee injury instead of, you know, playing through the injury and possibly worsening it. But it was really hard to expect him to come back this strong. And I think there are 2 general kinds of reasons people give for this huge streak. And one is kind of mental. And after you've had a career like his, anything else is kind of gravy. Adding another slam onto the huge 17 slam pile that he's built up over his career so far. He's just been playing a little freer, a little looser, especially against Nadal, who's really seemed to get in his head in a way that no other player on tour has. So that's been new to see. A little bit of aggression on important points where you might have previously seen tightness or some anxiety. So as hard as it is to speculate about a player's mental state, I know it's the kind of thing that I make fun of in other sports commentators all the time, but it does really feel like he's playing with a new sense of, I don't know, freeness or ease. And then there's a handful of good technical explanations for what he's doing too. And one thing people like to point to is the backhand. It had been a beautiful, effective stroke for obviously his whole unbelievable career, but now he's found a way to add a new little dimension to it. And he takes it a little earlier, he hits it a little bit flatter, and in particular in the matchup against Nadal, it's been very effective, and it takes a little time away from the opponent because he's hitting it so hard and so early on the rise.
I know it's hard to speculate about why it's the best tennis, but a lot of the technical things you talked about, for sure, the mental things, as much as we can ascertain. It's hard to guess, too, how long this might last, but what's your sense? Can Federer continue to ride this out through the rest of the year?
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see as he moves on to other surfaces, and grass is considered his specialty. He's been dominant at Wimbledon. So he, right after winning Miami, he said that he would be taking most of the clay court season off to prepare for what he called the season essential. And I think that by that he meant Wimbledon and rest of the hard court season in the U.S. leading up to the U.S. Open. So in some sense, you've noticed with a lot of these legends who are getting a little older, Serena Williams and Roger, they're picking their spots a little more. They can't really afford to play all the tournaments the way they used to.
Especially if it's not a favorable court, like you said, with the clay surface, not his best surface.
Yeah, I think in the grand scheme of things, it probably is wise for him to take a little time off. He is 35, as well as he's playing. You got to think that he'll need to rest up and recover in ways that he didn't have to early in his career. So clay being only relatively speaking a weaker surface, because he is still one of the best clay court players of all time. It's just that Nadal happens to be even better on that surface. It's probably a wise move for him. As much as I personally would love to see how he could compete against Rafa there, we probably won't see that until the French Open, when he's promised to return.
And speaking of the clay court season, that is Rafa's surface, known as the King of Clay. Is it his time to shine at Roland Garros and in the clay court season?
Yeah, I think Nadal himself was, you know, characteristically modest after losing Miami, but I really don't think he's going to have too much trouble based on the way he's playing. It's easy to forget in midst of how well Roger's been playing this year that Nadal has himself been to 3 championship matches. He's been 19-5 on the season. He's playing outstanding tennis. And given that some of his other main adversaries, like Murray's out for a few weeks with a shoulder tear. And Djokovic has been a little unsteady this season as well. So I think Nadal will have a great shot in the spring clay court season. He's got a few good chances at Rome, Monte Carlo, Madrid to get his bearings before he returns to French Open, where he's obviously won 9 titles and been so dominant in his career.
And he'll go for a 10th if he's healthy this year. What about Murray and Djokovic? Will they make a comeback this year? I think that's one of the surprising things we've seen, is that early in this tennis year, kind of fallen by the wayside for various reasons.
Yeah, Indian Wells was not a great tournament for either player. Murray, for whatever reason, has perennially struggled there, and he was knocked down in the second round despite having really soft, nice draw ahead of him. Meanwhile, Djokovic was stuck in a quarter with what jokingly we're calling the quarter of death. He had Federer in there, Nadal, Del Potro, Kyrgios, Zverev, the 2 up-and-comers. It was always going to be tricky for Djokovic to advance deep in that tournament, and for whatever reason, Kyrgios has a way of seemingly throwing him off his game. He's beaten Djokovic twice this year already. Actually, there are only 2 meetings ever, in Acapulco and in Indian Wells. They're both extremely entertaining matches, and they do make me wonder whether Djokovic will sustain the dominance that he had through 2015 and only falling off towards the end of 2016. So I would say I'm a little uncertain to see how long, for example, Murray will hold the top rank, given how many points he's defending the rest of the year, and whether Djokovic will bounce back from a slump, which may have to do with off-court issues as well. He seems not to be as mentally sturdy as he once was.
Yeah, there's been some kind of mysterious talk about personal issues that he's mentioned that he's dealing with. He hasn't really gone into that.
He's been very vague on those subjects, but it does seem to be something looming over his on-court play.
Yeah. Well, the past 10-15 years of men's tennis have really been dominated by these players that we were just talking about. Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, and Murray, the big 4. I guess we could call them the Big Five if you throw in Stan Wawrinka, who's won a few Grand Slams himself. Who is the next to break in? We've heard a lot about some of these young players, 18, 19, 20-year-old players. Who are the next big names? Who are the next maybe big two or three that we're going to hear about?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing that's interesting to note is that there's almost some kind of lost generation in between Federer, Nadal, and that cohort, and then you're looking at people in their mid to late 20s. And the two guys that I really thought had a shot were Kei Nishikori. He's been playing great tennis for the last few years, but now at 27, his body's durability raising some issues. It's unclear whether he's ever going to get that slam. And the closest he got was in 2014 at the U.S. Open final. Since then, he has not made it to a Grand Slam final. And you wonder if he sort of reached his ceiling. Meanwhile, someone else in their mid-20s, who I think still has a few years of good tennis ahead of him, is Grigor Dimitrov, who had been compared to Federer earlier in his career due to how similar their strokes look. They call him Baby Fed. And he's really come into his own this year. He had a fantastic start to the year, winning two titles, getting very deep into the Australian Open. He took Rafa to five sets. He's fallen off a bit since then, but I'd love to see how he plays on grass this summer. He's had some success at Wimbledon in the past. And I think after him at age 25, that's where things really get interesting. You've got 21-year-old Nick Kyrgios, who has been sort of a good electric shock to the whole tour this year, and 19-year-old Alexander Zverev, who I hope will develop kind of a nice rivalry over the course of their careers.
Yeah, these are the two that people are already talking about. They've faced a couple times already this year in some of these tournaments, and these are the two players that I think are being heralded as the future of tennis.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Just the all-around complete game that both of them have. And in fact, in some ways, it's pretty clear that they haven't reached their final form. Zverev is 6'6", and he's not quite serving the way we think he will with someone of that kind of height and natural ability. So I think they'll both be pretty scary competitors very soon. You obviously curious having some breakthrough wins, beating Djokovic twice. I'm really looking forward to him facing Federer at Indian Wells, and then he had to withdraw with food poisoning, but obviously we got the encore at Miami, and it definitely delivered. That was a three-set match that easily could have gone to him. He was up a break in the first set, but Federer managed to take it to a tiebreak. Three tiebreaks in that match, and obviously that's about as close as things can get.
So when do you think that they do break through? Is this the year that they suddenly break through to become maybe top 10, top 5, or does it take some time? Is it going to be a few years down the road?
I would not be surprised if Nick won a major in the next year, year and a half. I think his game will play pretty nicely on grass. I'm also pretty curious to see how he plays on clay. He's previously beaten Federer on clay. So his development seems pretty close to the level of technical maturity you need to win one of these huge tournaments. I think Zverev is still developing, but I wouldn't be surprised if it happened in a similar time frame, you know, year, year and a half, 2 years.
Setting up that perfect rivalry between the two of them.
Yeah, you got to hope that there's a solid decade of these guys going at it. And based on how entertaining their match was in Miami, as viewers, you'd be lucky to get that.
Tune in tomorrow where we'll have part two of my interview with Giri Nathan of Deadspin, where we'll talk about some of the big storylines in women's tennis this year and make some predictions about who could end the year as world number one. I'm Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. VOA!
Take your peek. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I'm Shaka Fali.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss Against All Odds, a book written by Cameroonian lawyer Angela Kwemo. It's a practical guide to making the most of your God-given talents and using them to better yourself, your country, Africa, and the human race. That's all on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. and our 5 minutes newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
The Voice of America. VOA.
Joining us here on the program now is Steve Miller of VOA English, making his Sunny Side of Sports debut.
Woo-hoo!
And Sunny's not even here, unfortunately.
I know.
But I'm in the host chair, so it's good to have you here to talk about what's trending in the sports world.
Yeah, some big, big news from the NFL today. Amazon is going to be streaming 10 games, 10 Thursday night games this upcoming season.
And this is something that the NFL has done before with Twitter.
Right.
They partnered with them on Thursday night games, but now they're expanding that onto Amazon.
Right. So last year, Twitter had the rights to 10 Thursday night games. It was a pilot program. Apparently, it was successful enough for the NFL to continue that. And this time, they're going with Amazon. Now, Google's YouTube and Facebook, as well as Twitter, all expressed interest. But Amazon won out on the bidding process. Last year, it was only $10 million for Twitter to stream the 10 games. But the price went up a whole lot this year. Amazon shelled out about $50 million for this.
Yeah, and that was a bargain last year. They said $10 million was nothing compared to sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars that different TV networks have to pay for these games. So even the $50 million, still a bit of a bargain, but a bit of a gamble for the NFL trying some new media to try to get these games out to the public.
Right, and it's also a gamble for Amazon because they're going to have to find a way to recoup that investment, because what they're doing is actually streaming the broadcast of the game. So whether it be NBC or CBS, who's hosting that broadcast that evening, they'll show the game in its entirety with their ads and also have some of their own ad space in the broadcast. But whether or not the eyeballs will be there is the big question.
Well, it is for sure. And we've talked about just before we went on the air that this is somewhat common in other parts of the world, but a new area for the United States.
Right. So for about 7 years, I lived in South Korea, and there they have a broadcast system called DMB, Digital Media Broadcasting. And it was a way to broadcast television programs to mobile phone devices. So back in the day when we had dumb phones, the clamshells, the sliders, whatever, you would buy it and it would actually have an antenna inside, and you would extend it and be able to watch any over-the-air program. So as someone who was living and working in South Korea, it was very routine for me to sit down on a park bench to watch a baseball game, to watch a soccer game. That was just life. So when I came back to the United States, it was very shocking for me to have so many limited options for streaming of sporting events, unless I was paying for a big package via an app or a special site.
Well, the hope, I guess, with this is that there is going to be more options going forward for people to watch these games. And I would venture to guess that Twitter and Amazon are only the beginning. It sounds like more and more of these partnerships, not just the NFL, but other sports leagues as well, partnering with social media outlets.
Right, and we saw a little bit about that with the Super Bowl this past year. Fox Sports broadcast the Super Bowl, and they have their own mobile device called the Go Program or Go Platform. And during the Super Bowl, while that's normally a subscription service to watch sports on the Fox Sports Go app, they made it free for everybody. So whether you're on your phone, your TV device, or even your tablet, you had the opportunity to see that sporting event with all the ads that people go crazy about during the Super Bowl.
And the trade-off, of course, for these sports leagues and the channels as well is that they are drawing in more customers at a time when many people are getting rid of their cable packages. There's a lot more a la carte pick and choose. And so if people just want to watch certain sports leagues or games, they can do that now.
Right. And I'll be honest. I cut the cord in 2005, and I don't miss it. And I rely on services like these to get the programming that I want.
I have a feeling a lot of people are going to be relying on these in the years to come. There's another trending story that we talked about earlier, a baseball player who had an unfortunate day.
Yeah, and this hit especially home to me. So Stephen Piscotty of the Cardinals was playing the Cubs last night, and he got hit with the baseball not once, not twice, but three times during the fifth inning of, unfortunately, their 2-1 loss to the Cubs. And, man, it was just hard to watch.
Yeah, it's a good day if you get three hits at the plate, not if you get hit three times with the baseball. Usually pretty rare, too, for players to get hit with a baseball. They're usually very precise with where they throw that, but sometimes you do get in the way of the throw.
You get a wild pitch. And what happened was, is not only was he hit at the plate, but also when he was advancing to second base, he got hit there as well, and then sliding into home as well. And for me, I come from an age where when I was in my youth playing baseball, we went from T-ball right to kid pitch. There was no coach pitching baseball. And the reason why I don't play baseball today is because during those first few games of kid pitch baseball, I got hit every single time I was up to plate because I'm 6'4", and I was just a huge, huge target. So whenever I see a professional player get hit, I just cringe.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of people were doing on social media, the videos going viral, but people expressing how unfortunate it is that he got hit so many times with
so many times in one inning. And that's the thing that is so unusual about this, because like you said, professional baseball players have such precision, such control over their throwing, whether it be the pitcher or anyone else on the team. To be hit, for one player to be hit three times in a single inning is almost unheard of.
Yeah, a lot of talk on social media too about the Cubs and their fielding. Maybe they're not going to repeat as World Series champions if they keep hitting their base runners on the other team.
That is true. Everyone has good days and unfortunately bad days as well, and who knows what this will mean for the Cubs during the remainder of their season, because it's just getting underway.
Hopefully better days ahead for everyone involved. And hopefully fewer players getting hit with baseballs in the season to come. My thanks to Steve Miller of VOA's English News Service making his Sunny Side of Sports debut. And an update now on an ongoing story. Yesterday, we covered the U.S. women's soccer and hockey teams and their fights for pay and resource equality with the U.S. men's soccer and hockey teams. And we reported that U.S. women's hockey had reached a deal with USA Hockey on increases in pay and resources going forward. Well, today, the U.S. women's soccer team has reached their own agreement with U.S. Soccer. The new deal will include higher pay and bonuses for the women's team, per diem pay equal to that of the men's team, and more training and travel resources. The 5-year deal will cover two of the world's biggest sporting events for women's soccer, the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup in France and the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo, Japan. Now, the deal drew reactions from across women's soccer, many stars weighing in on social media and online. U.S. soccer star Mia Hamm, who helped lead the U.S. team to victory at the 1999 World Cup, wrote on social media, quote, "Happy to hear that the U.S. women's national team and U.S. soccer have reached terms on a new collective bargaining agreement. They worked incredibly hard to improve the future of the game." Star U.S. midfielder Carly Lloyd, who earned the honor of FIFA's 2015 and 2016 Women's Player of the Year, tweeted out that she's happy an agreement has been reached. Other players have been tweeting throughout this process, encouraging U.S. soccer to reach a deal and are no doubt happy that they have. And we're also hearing from U.S. soccer itself. U.S. soccer president Sunil Gulati said in a statement, quote, "We believe this is another important step to continue our longstanding efforts to drive the growth of women's soccer in the United States. The agreement helps to ensure the strength of the women's national team, provides stability and growth potential for the National Women's Soccer League, and over time strengthen the elite player development process at the grassroots level." He goes on to say, "We believe our continued partnership will ensure a bright future for our sport for the years to come." So, very good news for U.S. women's soccer.
Hello, this is Magnus Chisom calling from Imo State in Nigeria. I love listening to the Sunny Side of Sports. It's always a daily delight of listening to the Sunny Side of Sports. Once again, Magnus Chisom and we are calling from Imo State in Nigeria and wishing all the Sunny Side of Sports listeners all the best.
Well, thank you for those well wishes. And that wraps up the April 5th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger, VOA engineer Nick Ivanov, and thank all of you out there for tuning in. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski here in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States recently honored 13 exceptional women from around the globe for their perseverance and leadership in helping promote justice in their communities. First Lady Melania Trump presented the Women of Courage Awards. Their lives remind us of the boundless capacity of the human spirit when guided by moral clarity and desire to do good, she said.
These are the stories of human greatness that will continue to inspire and therefore must be told far and wide. These honorees who have fought on the front lines against injustice are true heroes. Their stories of individual bravery remind us that there is always hope whenever the human spirit is brought to bear in the service of others, and that healing and personal empowerment are often born from such deeds.
Three of the 13 awardees were from the Africa region. Arrested at the age of 22 for peacefully calling for credible elections in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rebecca Kabugo became one of the youngest female prisoners of conscience in the world. Upon her release in 2016, she emerged as a voice demanding democratic reform and social change. Malebongo Malefi was a national basketball player for Botswana when she became crippled after being shot 8 times by an ex-boyfriend. Now wheelchair-bound, she has become a tireless advocate for victims of abuse in her country. United Nations peacekeeper Major Aichatou Issaka Ousmane of Niger works on the front lines of conflict and peacebuilding, helping survivors of terror and bringing social services to those affected by violence from groups such as Boko Haram. These women are truly leading the charge to fight for those that cannot fight for themselves, said Ms. Trump.
Together, we must declare that the era of allowing their brutality against women and children is over, while affirming that the time for empowering women around the world is now.
The U.S. congratulates these women of courage from Africa and their fellow awardees from around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss Against All Odds, a book written by Cameroonian lawyer Angela Kwemo. It's a practical guide to making the most of your God-given talents and using them to better yourself, your country, Africa, and the human race. That's all on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30. UTC.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.